Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome for another episode. Today, we are recording episode 211, I believe. And I really appreciate your time with me today as we go through another conversation. I'm excited about this one. It's a bit different, this particular conversation. We never really talk about this topic, but we should be talking a little bit more about it. Today, we are talking about decentralization. It's not just a technology. It's the ultimate safeguard in human privacy. So my guest of honor today joins me all the way from Dubai, and his name is Murphy John, and he works for StoreX Network. Welcome to the conversation, Murphy.
Hey, Ayoub. Good morning. Thanks for having me with the podcast. Really excited to be a part of it.
No problem. And you can call me Robin. I'm fine with that. My first name is Robin. My last name is Ayoub. I am from the Middle East originally. If you want to say a few words in Arabic for your audience in the Middle East, happy to conduct a conversation with you in Arabic as well.
No, I'm pretty well fluent in English. That would be great to talk to.
Absolutely. So for the audience, what if the biggest risk of your business data isn't hacker breaking in, but vendor you're already paying to hold it? There are many incidents of those. Today's guest has spent over two decades in the intersection of enterprise IT distributed infrastructure, and he arrived at a pointed conclusion. The centralized cloud model isn't just expensive, it's structurally fragile. By design. Murphy John is the Chief Growth Officer for StoreX Network, where he leads the expansion of a decentralized storage ecosystem, now running across more than 3,000 autonomous node worldwide. This is pretty important, guys. For organizations managing multilingual content, which the industry that we work in, that I work in, across borders, clients, there's compliance issues, there's sensitive data pipelines. Of course, those are inherited part of our business models in a lot of cases. StoreX is building isn't a niche experiment. It's a directly challenge to how global teams think about where their data actually lives, who controls it. Murphy, welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat one more time. And I'm really glad to have had the opportunity to have you on the show and to have this particular conversation. It's a very important conversation that we need to have today. Before we dive into it, Murphy, if you don't mind, on this channel, everybody's got a story, and I asked this question just to get to know the individual on a personal level. What is your story? What got you here?
Okay, so I'll start from the basics. So I graduated somewhere two decades back, and I'm very fascinated with the internet. Came back. I'm actually born and brought up from India. I came from a beautiful city called Mumbai. That's called as the financial capital of India. And when I was just graduating, internet was just coming into the age. So that's when internet just started in India. And it was a great thing to get knowledge about internet, see how it was working. And then at that point of time, the government of India decided that the students would have some good discounts. We were given like 80% discounts, 80 to 90% discounts. So we had to pay only 10% of the charge just to feel the internet, because it was something that's going to be future. The government thought that it has to be populated around the students, and the students were the one who absorbed it very well. So I was very lucky. I was among the first batch of students who got to experience the internet, found it very interesting, and got too much excited to it. And it was something phenomenal. It was like something beyond thoughts that we could, like something could like this could happen around the world, where we get connected to people all around the world with one same network. And we were in India. That means the communication cost, communicating with someone who is outside India, was very, very high. Email, chat, and all those things were really very fascinating, and we really dived into it. And I was lucky enough, I got interested. I got some good mentors around the world. They trained me, and I got to hang off the infrastructure business altogether. I came to know how the TCP/ICP were working, the internet protocol, the infrastructure required, the connectivity, the data centers. And that's how soon after the college, I thought that this is going to be the future. I have to be the part of it. That's what I connected to the internet. And I joined this company, which was like setting up internet infrastructure, managing infrastructures for the for all the corporate companies. We were working with, very fortunate to work with very big companies, very great leaders. And the best part was we were very young. And those leaders were very aged, but they're very fascinated. They wanted to learn. And the only way they could do that was connecting to us. So that was like we get to know. We were setting up their internet infrastructure, like web servers and infrastructure, and the security for them, doing websites, managing websites. And that that's how my fascination turned into a full-time profession. Very fortunate for that too, because very few people get the chance to have that kind of thing. I was really very fascinated with this infrastructure, way internet works, and then started dwelling into it. And that's how matured. And then we started seeing, because it was such a big power and there were very few hyperscalers that were controlling the entire data market, and started looking at the negative sides of it. That's when I came to know that there's so much of problems which were like, which we were not aware of. Because of the centralization, if you see, like in 20 years, we just have 4 or 5 hyperscalers who are controlling the entire data, entire life cycle of the data for human beings. So that's like very big thing. Then there was like the Cambridge Analytical scandals. Then there was things like ransomware virus, which got infected. Then there were people who were trying to attack your data, and so many cases that we came saw. So we started looking and dwelling into how we could secure the data. So that's how we started looking into ways which could be totally different in which how the data is stored. Because in the 20 years or 25 years when the cloud was just coming, the fundamental way in which the data is stored is still the same. It is the same, still the same before 25 years, and it's still the same now. What happens is whenever almost if there are 5 people of the 10 people in the room, and they're seeing some kind of data, would end up like 80% of the data would end up with these 4 hyperscalers. So what that means that these hyperscalers are controlling your life, your data, and they hold enormous power, which is like really very big risk. And that's when we realized that if some, like I would like to bring 2 or 3 cases which happened in the world. One was last year, October, there was a downtime of one of the hyperscalers, and it created havoc in everybody's life. The Amazon site went down. It was just one region, and that created a whole lot of rolling effect. Was so much huge. You had banks which was not working. You had airlines which stopped. Governments were not working. So it is a very critical part. So what we thought was we started looking into ways how we could secure the network, we could secure the data in a much more better way, where we needed to rethink how the data is stored. And that's how we got interested in this decentralized movement. And because of the blockchain technology, because of this whole, there was ways in which you could secure the data, and then at the same time incentivize people who are like thousands of kilometers away. You don't have to be in the same location, same geography. And that's how I started getting interesting. And we joined this company, the Storex Network. And then I was with this company, helping them to grow, getting in more use cases, getting clients to sign up, and a whole new journey altogether from the centralized.
So tell me, thanks for that. I appreciate it. Thanks for the background. Very fascinating. Who owns Storex, and what is the structure of the company? Is it a subsidiary of another company, or is it a privately owned? Can you talk to us a little bit about the structure of the company?
Currently a community owned. It's currently a community owned company. Ms. Handy Barrow is the CEO and the founder. He owns the majority of the company, and then it's powered by community tokens, which is called SRX tokens. So basically, that's how the structure is. It's the founder is Mr. Handy Barrow. So he's a very charismatic leader, very forward-thinking guy to come up with such a technology and do some work on this.
Well, tell Mr. Hani Baruch he's welcome on the LFC podcast anytime. If he wants to drop by and say hello, I would love to have him here and get the story as well on his side for Storex. That'll be perfect. If you know, I invite I extend the invitation for him to come on the podcast and tell the story as well. Now, when we talk about, you know, in your position, Murphy, Chief Growth Officer is a broad mandate, you know, Storex. And, you know, try to understand a little bit to get the customers or the audience to understand a little bit about who is your customers. So at Storex specifically, what does growth mean to you? Is it adding more nodes? Is it enterprise clients? Is it developers, ecosystems, or all the above?
So it's all the above, actually. So because you need, first of all, the very important backbone of this network is the storage node operators. So we want many, many node operators, which are distributed physically across multiple geography. The more number of nodes I bring into the network, the more robust I can make the network. So that's like creating a robust and a resilient network. I need more node operators. So I work with a lot of node operators community. The second one is working with the developer community. So the end user would not be able to, because storage is something that the developer decides and he chooses and he uses. So we work with a lot of developers community, we give them a lot of incentive. We give them a lot of POCs to work with. We work on many successful projects and many unsuccessful projects as well. But that's how we grow the network. And finally, my mandate is to talk to customers, end customers, who would like to see the power of how they can secure the way and why. Because this is a whole new technology which is there, and it offers horizon, the entire horizon which the data is stored is matters fundamentally different. So that they need an understanding like how this system works. So that's where I work with all three partners. They are strategic partners for our growth, basically.
What does a node operator mean? Give me an example. Who are these node operators?
Okay, so currently we have a community of node operators who have been supporting us right from the inception when we started. These are individuals who have storage nodes which are kept in certain IDC across the world. So what they do is, in order for me to have the robust network, I need to have node operators which are spread geographically rather than concentrating a node either in Middle East or in specific geography. So what we do is we have multiple node operators which are spread worldwide. They go to the local data center, they hire the servers for that, and they bring that servers for us to store the data. So we can keep it in a distributed way, much more secure way.
And what does your business model look like? Like, how do you charge for your service?
We charge based on the space that is consumed by users.
So terabytes? Megabytes, is that?
Yes, so it is a terabyte. So we have three different packages. We have a free tier, which is 2 GB. So people up to 2 GB can just register online, use it till 2 GB. Then we have a 500 gig plan and a 1 TB plan, depending upon this. And this is the package which we sell to users. But with developers, we have a lot of stages. They come up with different kind of requirements. And then based on their requirements, we give them the storage. So it's use case basis.
Okay, so let's move on a little bit. I'd like to understand a little bit more. How does a file work when I store files, let's say, on your StorX network, right? So walk me through what actually happened to a file when someone stores it on the StorX. I don't want the marketing version. Like, I don't want the brochure. I want the actual honest plumbing, if you will, mechanics of how a file works. Let's say, for instance, example, I have 200 files and you have 300 nodes, and some of these nodes go on offline simultaneously. What happens?
Okay, so that's the fascinating. So we have great orchestra. So what happens is, whenever you're using StorX to upload the file, so from your laptop itself, the file gets encrypted. So before the file reaches the platform, the StorX network, it's already encrypted by your own unique key. And once the encrypted file, once they come to a platform, they are broken down into small fragments. That is multiple small fragments. And these fragments are then replicated. And then we send it across to the network of nodes. So depending upon what is the size of your file, the system will decide like how much fragments has to be made. And then they'll replicate that fragments and then distribute all of the nodes. So what happens is, because of this fragmentation, the data is never residing as a single file in a single location. It will always be fragmented into multiple pieces. And because of that, it is like remains really very private. Nobody in the network, no participant in the network, including we at StorX Network, can ever view your file. That's one thing. The second thing is, because we are replicating those fragments into multiple pieces, no fragment will be like lying in just one location. It would be either 2 or 3 or 4 locations, depending on what the file sizes and what is the kind of the.
So in this is a bit, you know, for the people listening to this, they're going to say, well, okay, well, hang on a second now. I've got bits and pieces of my files distributed across many nodes or many storage area or storage networks or storage devices across the nodes. So what guarantees, what system guarantees for file integrity and availability when nodes are operated by independent parties?
Yeah. So what happens is, whenever a node operator becomes decides to be a part of the network, he has to stake in certain trust in it. It's like a deposit that he keeps. And then the deposit is always ensuring that he is always monetized. Like he whenever he gives a quality to the network, his node is marked as an active network. The moment is he is not giving any quality parameters, is not performed, he would be ruled, he will be thrown out of the system, and his node would be marked as inactive. And then he doesn't have any incentive. He's not paid for storing the data. That's it. So that's the kind of incentive mechanism that we have designed around the platform, so that every node operator is incentivized to remain active, ensure that they meet quality parameters and they get paid.
And what about the individual contributor? What about the individual customer who uploaded their files to the system? I know you've got some mechanism for the node operator, but what guarantees the individual, somebody like me, for instance, who uploaded 200 files to your network?
Yeah. So we have designed the system in such a way, as I told you, because of the replication fragmentation, we ensure that your file is located at multiple locations, and these are physically multiple locations. Mm-hmm. What happens is, the system will decide and will ensure that you have 3 or 4 replicate fragments of single piece of data. So the percentage of those nodes located multiple locations going down is very, very low. So that's what ensures that the file is always there. And even in case of one file, one fragment is not remaining, the file can still be stitched back from an alternative location. The second thing is the technology is designed in such a way that even with like 60% of the data that we have, we can still get your file back intact and given to you.
That sounds almost like a cloud. It sounds like cloud storage, isn't it?
Yeah, this is basically a cloud storage, but in a decentralized.
Okay. Now, you mentioned in one of your, when I was doing research on you, you mentioned backing up Google Workspace, Jira, and as a business case or as use cases.
So those are exactly what we're doing is we work with individual applications and packages to store the data. So suppose like we have a use case with Google Workspace. So what happens is you can actually back up your Google Workspace. You can back up your Google Docs. You can back up your Google Photos into a location. And it creates a memory intact in such a way that you will be able to access it even if Google is down. So we create a replicate copy of your data in our platform where you can just go and check in your mails even if the Google platform is not available for you to check. So you can set it in auto mode. So like that, we have created individual backup use cases for specific softwares.
Sorry about that.
You don't want to.
I'm fine.
It's okay. We can just, I don't
know. Don't worry about it. We'll edit that one. Don't worry. I'll edit this one.
No, I don't feel you're too okay. That's right. If you want
no,
to
no, no, I'm fine.
Day, it's always fine with me.
It happens. Don't worry about it. So, okay. Just to continue on, if you don't mind, how does a user actually set it up when it comes to Google? Is that a user, individual user, or is it at the company level?
So you can set up as an individual user. You can set up as a corporate entity. You just have to sign in storex.io and you need to connect your Google account with Google SSO. And then your mail gets started auto. And then you can set in. You have two modes to backup. You can either do a manual backup or you can do an auto backup. Auto backup means you can set up the frequency of your backup. You want to do it every week, every day, or every month. So you can create those copies inside Storex without anybody being worrying or without any other process. So it's simple. It's just a 5-minute process.
What is the price comparison against native cloud backup? Like, what is the price comparison?
So when you compare to, so there are two factors which we would like to clarify. One is the price and one is the egress cost. So what happens is when you're storing with cloud service providers, you have two costs which is included in. One is the, as I told you, storage and the egress cost. So we don't have egress cost attached to our devices. That makes us very, very cheap compared to the others, because this egress cost sometimes works more than 60 to 70% of your invoice, which is generated because of the storage and accessibility.
And so that would be comparison to what? Google or Atlassian or one of those?
You compare to any service providers, majority of all of them are having some kind of egress cost, and this works out really very big when you keep on increasing the amount of data that you store and access on the cloud.
So now I appreciate that and the audience listening to this, they got another option now. But most people use Google Cloud or Google Storage to store their, including myself. I have like 2 terabytes on Google right now, and I pay for that monthly. And I use that for storing everything I have from a digital perspective, photos and a bunch of other things. And Google Drive, for instance, I use Google Drive as a platform. Now, there is something called Decentralized Physical Infrastructure Network. It's called, for the audience, it's called DPIN. And DPIN is a term that a lot of people in our audience have heard about, but couldn't fully define. Would you mind give us like a few minutes description of what DPIN is? And what does it mean, you know, for the conversation that we're having right now? And why is it gaining so much traction right now?
Okay, so it's a new way of decentralized or distributed way in how you do business. Basically, you're using distributed computing, distributed storage, or distributed devices which are spread worldwide, and then you bring them together and power your devices. So I'll give you one example. There's a service provider who actually has given an alternative to the mobile service provider in the US. So they pulled in a lot of individual entrepreneurs who just need to put in an antenna with the internet connection and power the mobile network. So that was one of the very unique cases, and they were able to offer very stable kind of mobile network in the local region. The second one is the airline data, which is there, the weather data, this is there. So there are individuals who have these devices or some kind of devices or some kind of computers that is actually placed in the house. They bring in the crowdsource, the information, and then they upload it to a certain platform, which ensures the data can be securely given to other people. So that's like ensuring the data and bringing source from multiple sources which are spread worldwide. So that's actually DPIN infrastructure, which is there. And this, like earlier, it was like individual companies who were doing it, and then they were setting up their own infrastructure and managing it across. But the scale at which DeepIn has grown is far beyond any individual enterprise or an entrepreneur who can set up the network or devices and gives us service.
So do you actually think DeepIn is genuinely a new category, or is it just a rebrand of an old idea? I was just thinking about BitTorrent. I mean, that's the same idea.
Yes, it's somewhat similar to it, but it's a new idea. We're trying to give service which is actually useful for the mankind, and in such a way that it incentivizes all the people who bring in the network, who bring in the devices, or who power the network together.
And who are these players in your industry right now? Like, who do you compete with in a decentralized storage slice like DeepIn? I mean, I'm sure you have somebody that you compete with. And how do you differentiate yourself?
So we do have. So if you compare our networks, the storage network, we are almost in top 10. We have 9 incumbents in ahead of us. There are companies like Filecoin, there are companies like StoreJ, there are companies like who are all basically into storage in one way or the other. The unique way in which we differentiate ourselves from all these guys is the way in which the storage network is powered. So if generally what happens is most of the network which take buy storage from individuals are buying it from the storage which is lying in their desktop, lying the storage devices which is spread, which is stored in the houses. So on the day one, we thought that we need to provide very reliable services. So our primary requirement to be a node operator is, in case if you want to bring in the storage to our network, your storage should be in the IDC. That's Internet Data Center. Because we are getting storage from the Internet Data Center, it ensures that there's some kind of quality which is given to our end use. So because of that, we are able to offer very high level of resiliency, redundancy to the data that we provide the network.
Now, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, StoreX is an open source. What does that mean in practice for an enterprise who's evaluating, not individual user, for an enterprise who is evaluating it in terms of, should I get on that technology or not? And how can they inspect or audit or customize?
So two things in that. So our source code is all open source. We have open source our source code. Anybody can go to GitHub and see the way in which we are processing the data. The only reason that we made our source code open source was we were very clear. We don't want to do any kind of mismanagement with the data. We wanted to ensure that the way in which we process users' data is always transparent. So being an open source, people are 100% ensured that there's no processing which is happening to the data in the background. Everything that is happening to the data and how it's processed, how it's sliced, how it's distributed is all in the network, and it's all appearing to the people. For the user who's looking to store data with us, that StoreX as a platform, when they're comparing to any other platform, the whole idea was being transparent to the users, giving them the highest level of privacy. That's why we can ensure, because of the open source code base that we have, anybody can go online and just audit. We have also open sourced the audit records which are there. So there were two companies who had audited our code base, and that's also available to the users when they go to the GitHub and see the report as well.
What does data sovereignty mean to you in this particular case?
For us, case of decentralized entity, just the complete control of the data. That means I decide who should see my data and I decide who should not see my data. So with decentralized cloud, because you're encrypting your data in the platform itself, in your local devices, it gives me highest level of control and privacy for my data. So that's data sovereignty for me.
So there is a lot of conversation. The reason I asked the question, there's a lot of conversation around the world right now, globally, around data sovereignty, meaning that I want to make sure that the data is, and that's some of our customers are saying that, the data is located in a certain geographical area, a country, a city, and I don't want that data to be outside of this jurisdiction. Like, I don't want it, data in transit and data at rest needs to be in those geographical area predefined. And that's specifically around, it's used a lot around the regulated industry. In the regulated industry right now, it's pretty obvious that data sovereignty is, you know, take a look at the banks in Switzerland, take a look at, various countries around the world, they're saying, I don't want my data to be outside of my country. I want it to be inside of the country. And when they talk about that, they're not talking about it from, you know, just repository of information in the country. They're talking about it, I don't want my data to travel to 2 or 3 different countries before it gets back to my jurisdiction. They call it data in transfer, or data at rest in a country, and it has to be encrypted end to end. How do you manage that? Or is that part of your, maybe it's not part of your model?
No, it cannot be guaranteed, because what happens is with storage or with decentralized technology, you cannot guarantee which fragment of the data is going to lie on this. So that's something that is not possible with this. So if you're looking for something like that, if your data is controlled by any regulators, it cannot be, this is not a good case for you. So that's one thing. But that being said, I just wanted to make you aware of the risk that is available because of keeping the data in one specific location. You must be aware of the war that happened, the ongoing war in the Middle East. So there were two data centers which were specifically targeted. And this, because of this data centers which is specifically targeted, because of the geopolitical scenario, the regulators wanted the data to be inside the country. And this was one of the biggest data centers which were there in the country. And because these data centers were attacked specifically, the whole system went down.
It's a single point of failure, right?
Yes. So that's something that the regulators need to think. Regulators, sure. It's an important perspective that they do have, that the data, critical data, should not be going out of the country. And data is now one of the critical infrastructure for a country as well. The data center is the critical infrastructure for a country itself. But at this point of time, there's so much geopolitical scenario, so much of risk, political risk that is there. Imagine your data is sitting in one specific location or one data center or one service provider, and it being affected due to this geopolitical scenario. What do you do in that case? So that's really something that the regulators need to think about it. And of course, as I said, anyone who is a regulated industry by any regulators, a decentralized cloud storage would not work for them. Having said that, we do work for specific use cases. But in that cases, we create the network inside the country for them. So we had an AI case. This was pretty interesting use case that came across to. I'll just explain you that. There was an AI company which wanted to process a lot of medical data. So they wanted the data, because of the strict laws that are there, because of, they don't wanted the data to live beyond the country.
Yep.
So we created kind of network for them inside the country, and the data remains intact. Nothing goes out of the country. So that kind of solution can also be built, but that would be a private network. That would be like, instead of going in for like 2000 nodes, data would be residing in four different nodes. That's the only difference that you have. But you have the same level of security.
So your customers are, and I'm just trying to figure this out right now, you have a business to consumer and you have a business to business.
Yes.
And so business to consumer, as you explained earlier, you go on storex.io and you enable it to connect with your Google, let's say, account, and it will take over from there. And for businesses, how does that work? Do they have to call a sales rep? Or they go on storex.io? How does that work?
So we do have channel sales. So we connect to a lot of channel sales which are locally there. They help them to organize, do the integrations and set them up from. So we work in the base of channels where people help them to integrate and set them up. They ensure that they get local support also from this channel. So that's something that we work with the channel.
Do you have any certifications like ISO, SOC 2, any of the other certification?
Because we cannot guidance, we cannot give you all the certification require your data to be in certain geography and certain location, because of the whole the beauty of decentralization is you don't do it in single geography.
Yeah, it defeats the purpose, basically.
Yes, defeat the purpose. That's right.
Yeah. Now, our listeners, Murphy, most of them, well, some of them, they run language operations. There are translation companies that exist in many countries. You know, one company would probably have, I don't know, 10 offices. I've seen companies have 50, 60 offices around the world in multiple countries. And global content workflow, meaning that, you know, your content can exist in multiple locations at the same time, as you were explaining earlier. And they are handling like files, multiple files, like TMs, and we call them TMs, translation memories, glossaries files, that's our files with terms specific to customers. And a lot of times they have AI training corpora, right? AI training data that sits in these files. What does a decentralized storage posture for them specifically look like?
So I'd give you one more example of a company which was using storage from our site for this LLM trainings. So what they wanted is they had a big chunk of proprietary data of their customers over a long period of time. They were also bound with the same thing. They did not want it to go in the cloud, for the data was very, very secure, and they did not want it to use it, or they did not want to expose the data to certain clouds. And they wanted to do it over geography itself. So for them also, we set up the same kind of network inside the country, where you just like a private network, and the data never leaves your geography or geophysics. Everything is secured inside the same network, and everything remains inside it. Nobody is able to access the data. except your codes, which are there connecting to the APIs that you want.
Now, how do you guys handle metadata? Like, how does StoreX handle metadata, for instance? And the reason I ask is some company in the content business, localization included, may not care who sees their documents or translated documents in the case of a language industry. But the TM, for instance, the translation memory and client glossaries are sensitive assets. But you mentioned earlier there are encrypted and for your eyes only. Is there a level of security on the encryption?
Yes. So we have the 250, it's kind of mintergate kind of security that is there for your data. It's 256. It's given the highest level of security that nobody can break. The one of the highest level of security which is offered is being implemented on this. And people can just go online and see the kind of security codes which are spread on our open source platform.
And so because the reason I ask is because let's say you're working in an environment, the business is working in an environment where you have levels of access, not because you have access to something, you can see it. You can see parts of it. And if somebody has a higher level of access, they can see another parts of the content or another parts of the data. Hierarchy of access, I guess. That's what I was asking.
Yeah, no. Currently, you have just one level of access. You can use a third-party software and put it in the API base, and then you can access it. But our storage would just work as a single point of runner. You have an API access, you can get access to the entire data, which is there.
And what is the biggest misconception, do you think, in enterprises have when they first start evaluating decentralized storage?
I think because of the hype that we had in blockchain, because of the crypto industry, which was not known for very good reasons, still feel that we still carry that burden across after 4 years. So that's the biggest burden that we have, I think. And that's the biggest mind shift that we feel would happen over the period of time, because it was associated, the blockchain projects were associated with cryptography, more with not good reasons. We still carry that burden. Otherwise, people are still trying, and it's a pretty new concept. So to be honest, nobody gets thrown out of the job for storing the data with Amazon, Google, or anything. So that's a new option that they need to explore and try over the period of time. So the mindset factor and this issues that I told you earlier were the main issues that we face in adoption.
And what objections do you hear mostly?
So it's basically the objection is around the trust factor that we have, but that's the only thing that we're working on. Like the entire decentralized platform is worked on the way the architecture designs and gives you trust. So if you see about blockchain, nobody can guarantee about Bitcoin or Ethereum or any blockchain projects. It's the architecture which ensures that it remains intact and it's secure.
And for companies, I mean, they're serving customers, right? And they may have obligations to these customers. I know in my case, in a lot of cases, we have obligations to certain customers. Like, we're obligated by their NDA. We're obligated by the contracts that we have with our customers. How do we handle their data? How do we store their data, et cetera? Which becomes not necessarily the enterprise asking the question. They're asking the question on behalf of their customers.
So that's right.
In your opinion, is the hesitation that you're seeing mostly is technical, legal, or cultural? Do you classify that, or can you classify it?
It's more of legal compliances that are there. Because what happens is we are still in that era where people are still trusting the brand name rather than the architecture. So something is guaranteed by the architecture, then you can trust them, or something you have to trust. Like what is the currency right now? Currency is just promised by the central bank, right? So you're trusting the central bank. And when we go on a decentralized way, we have Bitcoin, Ethereum, and all, it's just trusted by the architecture. That's the mind shift that still requires some work to be done over the period of time. That's what I feel.
Have you had any customer that says, hey, I don't want this, it gave you a hard no, basically. And then you managed through evaluation and properly educating the customer on flipping them back and changing their mind?
We come across these cases many times. Because what happens is, as I told you, nobody gets thrown out of the job for storing his data in GCP, Amazon, or they all know what they are.
Of course, because they buy, like the old saying, right? When you buy IBM, you keep your job.
So
it's a joke now.
We did have this kind of thing. We were able to convince some, and we're not able to convince some because a couple of other reasons. Every individual has his own case. But we did have cases where people were convinced. And they tried out. Of course, they tried out with a small thing, and then they wait slowly go on to the bigger things. But we had cases like this where people were convinced, and we did have cases where people were convinced and then they didn't want to go. because of a couple of reasons. So we had both the cases in both the sites.
In the initial outreach that somebody in your office sent me the email when we first started connecting on this podcast here before as a prep for the podcast, somebody mentioned to me that AI and multilingual data compliance are becoming more complex. Where exactly is the pain in this? And is the storage layer the access control layer, or is it at the contractual layer?
I think it's the contractual layer which has major problems around that.
Can you expand on that?
Because what happens, the way in which AI is growing is pretty phenomenal. We are still not ready, and the risk is yet to be seen. So I think the contractual level is still the big problem for that. And there'll be a lot of new cases or missed cases which you'll come to see over the period of time. But of course, it is one of the technology, just like decentralization, that's going to grow. You like it or not, it's going to grow, and it's going to grow phenomenally. And I think we are blessed to be in this time where we have seen the growth of internet, the growth of blockchain, and the growth of AI. So you've seen three major developments happening over the period of time in your lifetime.
And the reason all this is happening right now, I mean, you can tell, I mean, the environment around us globally is changing, right? So more people are asking, there's a technology shifting, as you mentioned earlier. Even AI, people are, I did a couple of podcasts on the rise of a small language model, the SLMs, where people are looking for, sovereign AI, right? And sovereign AI means that, I want to move away from, I'm talking about the enterprises now, not the individual users. Some of the enterprise wants to move away from the large models, your ChatGPT, your Anthropic, etc. And they want to build their own behind the firewalls. And, there's many ways you can do this now. So sovereign AI is a big discussion right now happening in North America, specifically in Canada and the European Union. And everybody's talking about, how do we apply sovereign AI? And I'm involved in several of these conversations. So does decentralized infrastructure make compliance easier or harder in this case?
So I think a setup which a secure center for them, which is geographically fenced across, would be an easy use case. But as I said, I'll not be the right person to comment on it because I need to dig down. That's not my subject of expertise. But I think a setup which is locally created specifically geofence for them would be the right kind of technology for them to go in for.
So let's move on to another bit more, I want to call it the pressure test segment. This is where we try to figure out together through the conversation, how does the customer view these things and bring them down to reality check, if you will. So let me play this for you. An enterprise skeptic who is potentially your customer has an SLA with AWS, and AWS guarantees them 0.99% of uptime. Now, if you're in Dubai and you just had the center hit, probably that 99.99% of it goes out the window. But I'm just speaking not in extreme scenarios, in regular scenarios. And they have a 10 years of audit history. So the legal team trust it because they have a 10-year audit history. What does StoreX offer that worth rebuilding that trust from scratch?
So as I told you, we are an open source project. So everything is open source, the way in which we're processing the data. And the way in which we are geographically distributed across the globe kind of gives you a hedge across this problem. Like the network going down, the data center going down, this is kind of risk which people can only feel because they have been there for 20 years. That makes a lot of difference. Our technology is still new. We're still like 4 years, 3 years down the lane, and it's still kind of gaining traction across the world. So we will still need some time to prove this. But this is the technology which is still robust, which is still very, which can guarantee you a lifetime security and stability of your data.
And so, for instance, when I was working in the telecom sector, we used to measure things by uptime. And I just mentioned that AWS offered 99.99% uptime. What is your offer?
We do offer the same kind of guarantee to our customers. And we do have a strict technology which enforces this. So that's a technology which is backing it and ensuring that you have 99.9% uptime. And we can guarantee that with the kind of penalties that we have. So we ensure that we have that kind of service guarantee given to our customer.
And you mentioned earlier it's an audited SLA, right? Am I correct?
Yes.
Service level agreement. So you have an audit and track trail.
We have audited our code base. So we have a code base which is audited by a security expert, which says what are the kind of processing that you're doing to the data and the network uptime. So that ensures that your service remains up.
So for those who are listening right now, and we just told them that you're operating multiple nodes and, you know, you take the files and these files go into multiple places. So what happened if they need their files at 2 a.m. in the morning and the node operator that holds parts of that file is offline? So what happened?
There's no way the node operator remains. That's the difference I told you, that the node is placed in the internet data center. Cloud is also a server that is kept in the data center. And they guarantee a minimum security and availability. That's why we told you that we are different from the other service provider. We don't keep the nodes which are there in the house. It's kept in the internet data center, which is online 24/7, 365 days.
So for the audience, this is very important. So you don't have to worry about, for instance, your data not being available, because this particular technology that Murphy and I were talking about today in a distributed fashion gives you the resiliency, if you will, and availability of your data, regardless of what happened in the future, specifically around where the data is being stored. And that data is being stored through a center, which guarantees uptime for your files. So I want to make sure this is out there as well. In your opinion, is there any weak point for this technology right now? Just to discuss the other side of the equation. Is there any weaknesses that you want to mention, or anything that we probably have not discussed in terms of, we've talked about the strength. What about the weaknesses?
So that's what, because it's distributed, I cannot, this is a major advantage as well as disadvantage. I cannot hold any regulatory data. So any data which is by regulatory concern and has to be geofencing done in specific country, I cannot do that. And because of that, there's some certifications which I cannot get in, because the certification also are created for cloud, which are in specific regions. So that's the two major disadvantages that they have for the users, because of which is like critical. But that's the real strength that we have, because we are distributing the data. We are like really robust and resilient. So that's advantage and disadvantage both for the same fact.
That's right. Now, if we were to have I don't know if it's part of your objective, but let's say it's part of your objective to be credible for in the eyes of the Fortune 500 companies and procurement departments of these companies. What is the one thing that you need to build in the next 12 months?
I think we will have to put in a private network where we can guarantee the same kind of services to all the users. Now we are distributed on a decentralized mode, but we'll have to have a distributed private mode where we keep our data across the multiple location, but all the nodes managed by us. So that would be something that we would be coming up with, and we're working on.
Do you work with governments, financial services companies?
Right now, no. So we don't work with any agencies.
Healthcare? You don't do that?
We work with healthcare, but those are like individual cases. Those are not like mass cases where you distribute and give. So we create use cases for those specific companies, and those use cases are put inside those specific countries.
Now, so, you know, we've talked about this before. Data sovereignty should be a right, not a luxury. And 5 years from now, what does the world look like if StoreX win? And what has actually changed for a company handling global economy or global content?
I think now the people will start trusting the network. There'll be more things which would come in. We would be regarded as one of the... So we would be having very specific use cases where we would be much more better compared to the other incumbents, yep, like the centralized storage. And those would be the niches where we would concentrate heavily. So we would be look like a backup is a very important case that we have. Because we are doing this distribution encryption all, we offer much more value compared to any centralized service providers. So that's the use case that we are really working on. We have like 60 plus softwares which are integrated. We have backups created for specific use cases like Gmail, Kubernetes, and all those things. So we would be concentrating on those use cases, and we'll be growing across that.
So do you think it's primarily a technology shift, a regulatory shift, or a cultural one?
I think there's a mind shift.
Mindset shift, yeah. I can see that. And people have to believe in it, right?
Yes.
So to get them in, since it's a new technology, are you offering like any entry programs or entry offers?
Yes. We do work with, as I said, we do work with a lot of developers. We work with individual companies who want to try this out in a big way. We give them very holistic plans where they don't have to pay for 6 months, 8 months. Just keep on trying, seeing the data, how it's coming and how. So that's how we're growing right now. So we do offer a lot of... rebates, we do offer free POC programs. We do work in partnership with a lot of developers to help them to onboard their existing projects.
And for the audience, look, if you're interested in this conversation, if you like what you're hearing and you want to get a hold of Murphy, please reach out to me. I'm connected to him on LinkedIn now. And I will put you in touch with Murphy and we'll facilitate a conversation. You know, I'm open to doing introduction to my guests and my audience, and that's a free service I offer. My objective here is to connect you guys together and hopefully something good happen out of this conversation. I am sure the entire discussion around storing data in a world where if I step out and I speak about it from a 100,000 foot level, with the age of AI, there's a lot of content being created. Actually, text, the amount of content is being created for all of us as people. And this is a logical conclusion. Why? Is because before the age of AI, we were human creating content based on our own speed, based on our own output capacity. And then we enabled this with AI. And now with the press of a button, you can create a book, for instance. And you can create a document. You had to actually sit down and write that document for 2 weeks. Now it takes you 15 minutes to create it. It's a good thing. It's convenient. What it's doing, it's expanding the amount of content that we need to store and where do we need to store it. And that's why this conversation is very important today. You're creating more content. You are going to run out of space. And therefore, you need a place to store it. And that conversation with Murphy today is really, really interesting. And it's timely. Because every second conversation I'm having on this podcast, it's about AI and how are we dealing with AI and the implementation of AI, which consequently, it's going to create more content. So if it's going to create more content, you absolutely need a place to store it. So hence, that's why we're having this conversation with Murphy today. Someone in our audience is pretty much translation companies, owners, or tech operators. I do a lot of conversation with tech operators, similar to the conversation we're having today, Murphy. They're curious, but not convinced yet. What's the thing you want them to walk away thinking about today after our conversation?
The best way would be to try this out. They can reach out to us. We will be able to work with them for POCs. We need to work with them for partnerships, and they can try out and see. Because as I told you, nobody gets fired for working with Amazon, storing data with Amazon. This is the only experience that we can offer them, and they'll feel how it makes difference.
And nobody gets fired for coming on the localization fireside chat.
Yeah.
They can come in, have a conversation with Robin, and they'll do it okay. They'll do okay. Is there a free tier program, a low-risk entry point? Yeah. Is there a code you want us to publish for you? I can publish a code for you.
It's a 2GB free for life package. You can just come and register for 2GB, and you can use it as long as you want till the time you used to. And you can use it. You can use all the features. There's no limits to the features. You can use it and see how it's working. And then once you're convinced, you can just upgrade it.
And where do you think the audience should go to learn more about your technology? StoreX.com?
Yes, StoreX.com would be the right site to come in.
Absolutely. For the audience, look, I truly enjoyed this conversation. My background is technology, and anytime there is a networked solution out there, I want to find out more about. I want to thank Murphy John for coming online today with me. What do you think of the conversation?
It was great. It was amazing. We had some deep dives.
Did I forget to ask any questions that you wanted to cover, or?
No, I think you've covered a lot of points.
No, I really appreciate your time with me, Murphy John. I really got out of it what I needed to get out of it. And I'm sure the audience enjoyed it thoroughly. And in the future, if you have any update, please come back to the network, and would love to have you as a guest. And it's an invitation open to your founder as well. If he wants to come in on the network and have a conversation with me, happy to host them. For the audience, I want to thank, on your behalf, I want to thank Murphy John. Any last comments before we terminate?
Oh, no, I think it was great.
Thank you, Murphy John. I really appreciate it. And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me on this podcast recording. If you're coming in on our YouTube channel, thanks for watching us. If you're coming in on our audio channels, thanks for listening in. And if you're reading the blog post where I summarize these conversations, thanks for subscribing. I really appreciate your time. And also, I want to thank everybody for keeping us in mind, for subscribing, for sharing the content, and for making us top 5 worldwide in a category podcast. Thanks so much, everybody. And thanks. See you at the next episode. Sometime today, I'll be recording another 5, I think. Thanks so much. And I'll see you next time. Bye now. There you go.